Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy, Pete Musto, and Lucia Milanic. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Venezuela was once one of the wealthiest countries in Latin America. Today, images of poor Venezuelans eating from food waste in Caracas are evidence of the country's deepening economic crisis. Young men and boys often search the dirty waters of the Guaire River for small pieces of metal that might help feed their families. One of these young men is 26-year-old Angel Villanueva. He searches the dirty brown water for lost rings or other objects he may be able to trade for money. Working in the Guaire isn't easy, he told the Associated Press. When it provides, it provides. When it takes your life. The waters of the Guaire are known for being filthy. The river acts as a drain. It carries away rainwater from the streets and sewers, as well as industrial waste. Alejandro Velasco is a native of Caracas and teaches Latin American history at New York University. He says, "As long as I can remember, the Guaire was this open sewage. It certainly seems to reflect the depth and extent of the desperation that this particular crisis has spawned. Venezuelans have lived under socialist rule for nearly 20 years. During that period, food and oil production have dropped sharply. Poor organization of state resources and a drop in world oil prices have made many Venezuelans desperate. Each morning, people go to the Guaire River from nearby neighborhoods to search for treasure. Some cover their fingertips in tape to protect from cuts and infections. They largely ignore any possible long-term health effects from standing in dirty water for hours each day. Calls to clean up the river and the large amount of money already spent have had no result. In 2005, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez recognized the river's filthy condition and promised a full cleanup. 7 years later, the Inter-American Development Bank provided a $300 million loan to build wastewater centers and treat waste that goes into the river. Nearly 6 years later, the water remains filthy. Bank officials refused to comment on the project. Venezuelan government leaders have also been silent on when the Guaire might be cleaned. Some parts of the river smell of sewage. Other parts produce a toxic, harmful smell. Most days, the treasure hunters go unnoticed by other people as they drive vehicles over the river on a major road. Angel Villanueva lives with his father in one of the poorest and most dangerous parts of Caracas. The son wanted to earn money, but he could only get low-paying jobs, such as cleaning the streets. The lowest legal wage for public employees in Venezuela is less than $7 a month. Food has become increasingly hard to find or very costly. One recent study estimated that 75% of Venezuelans lost an average of 8.7 kilograms last year. Angel Villanueva first started searching in the river 6 months ago. His first day's work resulted in finding $20 worth of materials. People back in his neighborhood often tell him to keep away because he smells like the wire. Villanueva dreams of leaving Venezuela to find a better job. But for now, he is taking his chances searching for treasure in the river.
Martin Luther King Jr. was an American leader of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. King is remembered for his nonviolent protests against the unequal treatment of African Americans. His actions led to equal rights laws for all people. One of the most famous events related to him came in 1963. That year, more than 250,000 people gathered in Washington, D.C. for the March on Washington. King spoke to them on the steps of President Abraham Lincoln's memorial. He delivered a historic address known as the I Have a Dream speech. One of the most famous lines from the speech reads, "I have a dream that one day little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers." King's actions helped pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The law ended the legal separation of people by race in public places. The act also banned job discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin. King and other activists watched the president sign the law. The Civil Rights Act was important, but it did not address all kinds of racial discrimination. For example, black Americans still did not have the same voting rights as white Americans, especially in southern states. So, in March of 1965, a group of activists in Alabama marched in protest of unequal voting practices. State police attacked the protesters. Some wanted to answer with violence, but King urged peaceful action instead. The events in Alabama pushed Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act. It was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson in August of 1965. In the following years, King worked for economic equality. In April 1968, he was attending a workers' strike in Tennessee. While he was standing outside his hotel room, a sniper shot him in the face. King soon died of his wounds. The shooter was identified as a criminal who had escaped from jail. James Earl Ray was a white man who said he hated King. Ray was found guilty and sent to prison. King is remembered for many things, including his focus on nonviolent action to achieve social and political change. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Imagine a cat that does not need someone to clean up after it, keeps an older person company, and helps them remember to take their medicine. That is the shared dream of the toy maker Hasbro and scientists at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. The researchers received a $3 million award from the National Science Foundation for a special project. The goal of the project is to find ways to add artificial intelligence, or AI, to Hasbro's Joy for All robotic cat. The cat has already been for sale for 2 years. It is aimed at older people and meant to act as a companion for them. It makes the same noises as a real cat and even appears to seek attention from its owners.
Researchers at Brown's Humanity-Centered Robotics Initiative are working to decide which activities older adults may need the most help with. Such activities include finding lost objects and reminding the person to take medicine or visit their doctor. Bertram Male is a professor of cognitive, linguistic, and psychological sciences at Brown. He said that the researchers do not want to make unrealistic promises of what the cat can do. He said he and his partner Michael Littman, a computer science professor, hope to make the cat perform a small number of activities very well.
They also want to keep the cost down to just a few hundred dollars. Hasbro's current Joy for All cat costs $100. They have given the project a name that follows that idea: Affordable Robotic Intelligence for Elderly Support, or ARIES. It is an idea that has appeal to Jean Elliott. Her 93-year-old mother, Mary Durr, lives with her in South Kingstown, Rhode Island. Durr has dementia. The Joy for All cat that Elliot bought this year has become a true companion for Durr. The robot cat stays with Durr and keeps her calm while Elliot is at work. Durr treats it like a real cat, even though she knows it is electronic.
Diane Feeney Mahoney is a professor at the Massachusetts General Hospital's Institute of Health Professions School of Nursing. She has studied technology for older people. She said the project shows promise because of the team of researchers. She called the cat a tool that could make things easier for someone caring for a person with middle-stage dementia. It could also be useful in elder care homes that do not permit people to bring in real animals, she said. But she hopes the researchers involve people from the Alzheimer's community. We just don't want to push technology for technology's sake, she said.
The scientists are studying how people feel about the robot cats, as well as the everyday lives of elderly people. They are also trying to learn how the improved cats would complete helpful activities and how they would communicate that information. Littman said they do not want a talking cat, however.
Cats don't generally talk to you, he said. Instead, they are looking at whether the cat could move its head in a special way to successfully communicate its message, for example. In the end, they hope to create an exchange between the human and the cat in which the human feels the cat needs them. By doing so, the researchers hope they can even help prevent feelings of loneliness and sadness among elderly people. I'm Lucia Malonig.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Hi, From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. John Quincy Adams was sworn in as President of the United States on March 4, 1825. A big crowd came to the Capitol building for the ceremony. All the leaders of government were there, senators, congressmen, Supreme Court justices, and James Monroe. Monroe's two terms as president were ending. President-elect Adams focused his inaugural address on unity. Adams said, "The Constitution and the representative democracy of the United States had proved a success. The nation was free and strong and stretched across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific." He noted that during the past 10 years, political party differences had eased. So now, he said, it was time for the people to settle their differences and make a truly national government. Adams closed his speech by recognizing that he was a minority president. No candidate had received a majority of electoral votes, so the House of Representatives had to make the decision. The House chose Adams as the next president. He told the crowd gathered at the Capitol that he needed the help of everyone in the years to come. Presidents-elect used to give their inaugural address before their swearing in. So after his speech, John Quincy Adams took the oath of office that made him the sixth president of the United States. His father was John Adams, the second president. John Quincy's mother, Abigail, made sure he received an excellent education. Historian Harlow Giles Unger wrote a biography of John Quincy Adams. Quincy, incidentally, is how the family pronounced it. The historian tells this story about Abigail Adams and her son in 1775 in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War.
When her firstborn son, John Quincy, was seven, they heard the cannon fire in the distance. They went up to the top of the hill behind their farmhouse and could look across Boston Harbor and see the Battle of Bunker Hill. And she took her boy by the hand. They went back down to the house, and she started melting down the family pewter with John Quincy helping her and making musket balls for the American Revolutionary troops.
Abigail and John Adams were strong patriots. They were one of the founding families of America. Harlow Giles Unger says Abigail Adams raised John Quincy to serve his country.
She told her son that if you do not grow up to be a great leader of this country, it will be because of your own laziness and obstinacy. She and her husband, John Adams, at that point decided to raise their son to be the President of the United States.
As a boy, John Quincy Adams learned to speak at least four languages and read Greek and Latin. He studied Shakespeare's plays. He traveled in Europe. He worked with his father in American consulates and embassies. He graduated from Harvard and was working as a lawyer by the age of 23.
He was a brilliant, brilliant young boy and man.
For about 25 years, Adams held mostly appointed jobs. He was ambassador to the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, and Britain. He helped lead the negotiations that ended the War of 1812 between Britain and the United States. And he served 8 years as Secretary of State. Adams spent most of his career working in public service. Harlow Giles Unger says he could be impatient, especially with lawmakers.
He despised most of the politicians he met in Congress because he found them to be ignorant and self-serving, with no sense of patriotism and sense of obligation to the nation.
John Quincy Adams did not care for political battles. When he became president, he tried to bring his political opponents and the different parts of the country together in his cabinet. His opponents, however, refused to serve. And although his cabinet included Southerners, he did not really have the support of the South. In his first message to Congress, President Adams described his ideas about the national government. The chief purpose of the government, he said, was to improve the lives of the people it governed. To do this, he offered a national program of building roads and canals. He also proposed a national university and a national scientific center. Adams said Congress should not be limited only to making laws to improve the nation's economic life. He said it should make laws to improve the arts and sciences, too. Many people of the West and South did not believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do all these things. They believed that these powers belonged to the states. Their representatives in Congress rejected Adams' proposals. Harlow Giles Unger says some of the disagreements during Adams' presidency helped start the American Civil War more than 30 years later in 1861.
The country was now splitting. Most of the South had never accepted the Constitution as such. The Constitution did away with state sovereignty, but many Americans never accepted that, and especially in the South.
The political picture in the United States began to change during the administration of John Quincy Adams. His opponents won control of both houses of Congress in the elections of 1826. Adams' opponents called themselves Democrats. They supported Andrew Jackson and wanted him to win the next presidential election. Democrats needed the support of both the West and the South to elect Jackson. So they proposed a bill that appeared to help the West. The bill involved import taxes. A number of Western states wanted duties on industrial goods imported from other countries. The purpose was to protect their own industries. Southern states, however, opposed the import duties. They produced no industrial goods that needed protection. They argued that the Constitution did not give the government in Washington the right to approve such taxes. The Democrats expected Congress to defeat the bill they proposed. They thought the West would be grateful that the Democrats had tried to help them, and the South would be happy that there would be no import taxes. But to the Democrats' surprise, many congressmen from the Northeast joined with lawmakers from the West to support the bill. They did so even though the bill would harm industries in the Northeast. The Northerners wanted to keep the idea of protective trade taxes alive. The bill passed in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. This left President Adams with a difficult decision. Should he sign it into law, or should he veto it? If he signed the bill, it would show he believed that the Constitution allowed protective duties. That decision would create even more opposition to him in the South. If he vetoed it, then he would lose support in the West and Northeast. Adams signed the bill, but he made clear that Congress was fully responsible for it. Democrats in Congress made other attempts to weaken support for Adams. For example, they claimed that he was misusing government money. They tried to show that he and his father before him had become rich from government service. Others accused him of giving government jobs to his supporters. This charge was false. Top administration officials had urged Adams to give government jobs only to men who were loyal to him. But Adams had refused. He felt that as long as someone had done nothing wrong, he should continue in his job. During his 4 years as president, Adams removed 12 people from government jobs. In each case, the person had failed to do his work or had done something criminal. Adams often gave jobs to people who did not support him politically. He believed it was wrong to give a person a job just for political reasons. Many of Adams' supporters could not understand. They had worked hard to get him elected. Their support for him cooled. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says, John Quincy Adams was never able to meet the high expectations many had for him.
His presidency was a complete failure. He was able to accomplish nothing.
The political battle between Adams' Republican Party and Jackson's Democrats remained bitter. Perhaps the worst fighting took place in the press. Each side had its own newspaper for support. The Daily National Journal supported the administration. The United States Telegraph supported Andrew Jackson. At first, the pro-administration newspaper called for national unity and an end to personal attacks. Then things changed. The paper had to defend against charges of political wrongdoing within Adams' party. It needed to turn readers away from these problems. So it printed a pamphlet that had been used against Andrew Jackson during an election campaign. The pamphlet accused Jackson of many bad things. The most damaging part involved the wife of another man. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.